Okay, I'd like to welcome you all to this really important, compelling session, which is going to be a discussion about the situation in Palestine and why we are for a free Palestine. The person who will be giving the introduction today is a very special international guest for Marxism 2018. Her name is Hawaida Araf. She is one of the founders of the International Solidarity Movement for Palestine, which is currently in operation and gives a lot of solidarity and support to the Palestinians on the ground right throughout the West Bank and in Gaza as well. She was also a participant in the flotilla of boats that attempted to break the siege on Gaza a number of years ago and was brutally attacked by the Israeli forces, and a number of activists were killed. Hawaida was on one of those flotillas in that project at the time. People might have seen some of the amazing footage of her staring down fully armed Israeli forces as they attempt to make their way onto Palestinian land in the West Bank and intimidate and brutalise the population there. And she was absolutely fearless in the face of that kind of military force and presence. So we have in our presence today a wonderful, brave, determined activist. So if everyone here could make her extremely welcome.
Thank you. Before I start, do I need to use the mic? You'd like me to use the mic?
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you to Socialist Alternative for inviting me. It's really quite an honor. And I'm learning so much just by being here amongst you. And one of the things that I love, that I've learned, is the acknowledgement the welcome to country. When I've witnessed those, it's so beautiful. And I just look forward to the day when all Indigenous people see that kind of acknowledgement of the land that was stolen from them, and hopefully the Palestinian people also soon, but Indigenous people everywhere. And so I want to thank you for being here and for teaching me just by being amongst you. I'll start by telling you a little bit about myself and work into what's happening now in the occupied Palestinian territory. Material indicated, and as Vashti indicated, I'm a Palestinian American. My parents left Palestine when my mother was about 8 months pregnant with me because they did not want me, I'm now the oldest of five children, to be born there and live a life under full military occupation, which is the town that my mom is from, called Beit Sakot, under full military occupation. My dad is from a town in the north, which became part of Israel in 1948. So it's way up, like, near the border with Lebanon, north of Akko. We became citizens. And so my father's an Israeli citizen. And Israel really likes to tell the world that it is a democracy and it has, all kinds of people. It doesn't discriminate. It has Palestinians that are citizens. It likes to call us Arab Israelis because it definitely likes to differentiate between us and Palestinians to kind of break those ties, but we are Palestinian and we assert that we are Palestinians. So we actually, just a tidbit, do not like to be called Israeli Arabs or Arab Israelis. But we do have citizenship. It is not a democracy, however, Israel. There are at least 50, if not more, because more laws are being legislated every day, laws discriminating against us because we are not Jewish. And that fits precisely within Israel's plan all along. In fact, Israel's founding father said that in order for Israel to be a viable Jewish state, it needs to maintain an 80% 20% population balance, 80% Jewish, no more than 20% non-Jews or Arabs. And later also said that we formulated our demand for not a Jewish state in Palestine, but for Palestine as a Jewish state. So in order to keep Israel now, as it's called, as a Jewish state, you have to keep the Palestinian population contained in numbers, contained in the levels that they are allowed to reach. And so these laws extend everywhere from, you know, not allowing Palestinians to return to their homes, and yet any Jew from anywhere in the world can come and get automatic citizenship in Israel, yet those Palestinians that were exiled, dispossessed, when Israel declared itself a state, cannot come home. And therefore there can be no kind of family reunification, the Palestinians that stayed and the Palestinians that became refugees. Palestinians can easily lose their citizenship. Israel says, for example, if Palestinian citizens enter or obtain citizenship in an enemy state, and it defines enemy state, it has a list, that it's something it can expand, we can lose our citizenship. Israel has approved these admission laws, admission committee laws, so there are committees, about over 200 committees throughout Israel in different communities that are able to judge whether, for example, I as a Palestinian want to go live in this community. Well, I have to apply this admissions committee, and if they deem me unfit, I don't fit the characteristics of the people that they would like in their community, then they can legally deny me entry to live there. And those admissions committee laws are specifically targeted, you know, to target the Palestinian community so as to contain where we are allowed to live. There are Bedouins that are Palestinians that are citizens of Israel. There are about 200,000 to 300,000 Bedouins. And a lot of these Bedouins actually serve in the Israeli military. And yet, many of them live in what Israel calls unrecognized villages. There are somewhere between 35 and 45 unrecognized villages. So they do not get any kind of municipal services. They don't get running water, they don't get sanitation, they don't get public transportation. And now, specifically in the south, in what is called the Nakab or the Negev, Israel is looking to whole-scale move these Bedouin communities to, you know, in one case, it's near a big, large garbage dump to evacuate their communities. For example, right now, the community and village of Umm al-Hiran, they recently received a demolition order, and there's a campaign right now as we speak to try to stop this demolition. Israel wants to remove them so it can build its Jewish town called Hiran. So it'll wipe out, you know, Umm al-Hiran is the Arab name, as Jewish town Hiran will be built after it moves these communities. And there are other communities like Al-Araqi, which has been demolished over 100 times. Israel brings in the bulldozers, demolishes these homes. The Palestinians insist to remain on their land. They'll rebuild, sometimes shacks, sometimes tents. The Israelis will build them, bring in the bulldozers again. And most recently, they have started charging the Palestinians for demolishing their homes. And these, again, these are just the citizens of Israel. I'm not even talking about the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. So my parents did not want to raise a young family there, and that's why they left. And before I move on, let me just acknowledge today is Palestinians Mark Land Day. In 1976, Palestinians, whole-scale Palestinian citizens, mainly demonstrated because Israel had announced a new plan to confiscate more land, to build Jewish towns, confiscate Palestinian land. So there was a big mobilization demonstration where Israeli forces killed 6 Palestinian citizens of Israel and injured hundreds, arrested. Well, and ever since 1976, every day on March 30th, we mark Land Day. And so throughout now, Palestine and really the diaspora, will be events marking Land Day today. So I was born and raised in the United States, and I did receive, I think, the education and the opportunities that my parents wanted me to have. And after graduating with my bachelor's degree, I accepted a job in Jerusalem because I started thinking, well, you know, what can I do to give back to my people, recognizing that most Palestinians didn't have the opportunities that I had, and I wanted somehow to give back. So I moved to Jerusalem in the year 2000. And at the time, we were in the Oslo peace process. I don't know if many of you remember, but in 1993, there was, you know, these big celebrations with, you know, the leader of the Palestinian, the Palestine Liberation Organization, Yasser Arafat, with the Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, really famous handshake on the White House lawn with Ben Palestinians, there were criticisms, but for the most part, people wanted to give it a chance. But what happened in those years, 1993 to 2000, was anything but moving towards what the Oslo peace process supposedly promised, which was an independent Palestinian state on only 22% of our historic homeland. So where it says West Bank and this little strip Gaza, the whole thing is our historic homeland, but Palestinians agreed that our state would be between these two disjointed territories, the West Bank and Gaza. But Israel didn't abide by these agreements, and through the years, what they did is continue to build illegal settlements. So inside the West Bank and Gaza, they had illegal settlements, and they expanded them. So between 1993 and 2000, the number of illegal settlers doubled. There were 200,000, they became 400,000. The number of home demolitions continued throughout the occupied Palestinian territories, and especially in Jerusalem, where Israel was looking to ethnically cleanse, really push Palestinians out of Jerusalem. Approximately in those 7 years, Israel demolished upwards of 740 Palestinian homes. Other restrictions, in addition to these settlements, they continued to take more land to build these superhighways to connect the settlements to each other so that these, Israeli Jewish settlers don't have to go through Palestinian villages. They can just go from their one colony to the next, inside into the borders of Israel. Therefore, when you're continuing to colonize under the guise of a peace process, it builds up frustration, and Palestinians were getting frustrated. So in September of 2000, when then Israeli opposition leader, he made a very provocative visit to Islam's holiest site in Jerusalem, they call it Temple Mount, called Al-Haram Sharif, accompanied by an estimated 100 security forces, security officers, went up to this holy site in really kind of a provocative message that even your holiest sites we can come to, which sparked a lot of anger, demonstrations, and Israel responded to these demonstrations with lethal force. So on September 29, 2000, Israeli forces killed four Palestinian demonstrators, and then more demonstrations broke out the next day throughout West Bank, Gaza, and even inside 48, inside Israel. And Israel continued confronting these demonstrations with lethal force. So that by the end, within a month, by the end of October 2000, 127 Palestinians had been killed. And, Israel was calling these riots. Really, I was participating in these demonstrations. They were largely unarmed demonstrations. Sometimes you'd have people picking up stones and throwing them at heavily armed soldiers or tanks. And, nothing that threatened the life of soldiers, but there weren't even stones running all the time. And yet, they were responding to us by opening fire. And not just to contain the demonstrations, no. They were shooting to kill because 80% of the deaths were caused by bullet wounds to the chest and head area. So Palestinians recognized this was a shoot-to-kill policy. Nobody was holding Israel accountable. And on top of that, Israel was blaming, the international community was, not civil society, but governments and the mainstream media, which kind of was repeating the mantra that Palestinians turned their back on the peace process. Yes, Fez was offered the best peace deal ever, and he turned his back on it, and he went back to his terrorist roots, and this started the second Intifada, and so Palestinians were being killed, no accountability, being blamed for their own deaths. What happened then is Palestinians became the popular demonstrations, the men, women, and children that were taken to the street, stopped doing so much. And the Intifada became armed. So those that had weapons in Palestinian society were using them to shoot at settlements, to shoot at tanks, to shoot at soldiers, to shoot at in ways that really didn't make sense strategically. We're up against one of the most powerful militaries in the world, and we have some old Kalashnikovs. Like, we're not going to defeat them that way. But it was still like, we have to fight. You can't do nothing. But that only gave cover for Israel then to fly its F-16s and bomb us from the air, roll their tanks into our towns and villages, and fire tank shells into our neighborhoods, which only increased the casualty numbers. So I was fairly new to the area. I had come back, after being born and raised in the United States, and wanted to still do something, but I couldn't participate in the armed resistance. And so I thought, honestly, I will admit, I was really naive, and I thought I had these great ideas about, you know, nonviolent protests and things that we can do, because, you know, I grew up studying Martin Luther King, and I grew up, you know, learning about Gandhi. I didn't grow up learning about the history of Palestinian resistance. And it was when I started talking to the elder Palestinians did I learn more about our first Intifada, which is really incredible. It wasn't the only instance of our resistance. Resistance goes back decades. But I think the height, I would call it the height of unarmed collective Palestinian organizing was our first Intifada in 1987 to 1993. It was also peace accords that really ended it. But at that time, the Palestinian leadership was outside of Palestine. The Palestine Liberation Organization, the Yasser Arafat, in Tunis. On the ground, you had communities organizing themselves in these, what we call popular committees, by region and also by neighborhood. Representative in these popular committees were people, you know, that represented the community and that were respected by the community. They had to be secretive because anybody that was any part of the resistance, Israel would arrest. You could be arrested even for just distributing flyers. But the way these popular committees operated, they had them throughout the occupied Palestinian territories, and then representatives from each would reach to a higher coordinating committee, and they, in a sense, propelled the Intifada, put a program of resistance, which Israel responded to very violently, arresting a lot of people. A lot of my friends who are of age spent years of their lives in prison, but did so proudly. We were, I don't know if many of you know, but Intifada comes from an Arabic word, Intifada, which means to shake off. So we were shaking off the occupation with massive forms of civil disobedience. And they shut down our universities, and they shut down our schools, in which case Palestinians responded by organizing underground community schooling for the kids. In my mom's town of Beit Zahor, they organized a big tax strike, refusing to pay taxes. Palestinians do have to pay taxes to the Israeli military, and they refused to do so there, which Israel responded to by going in and confiscating the personal property of all the people that were leading the tax revolt. But they didn't give in. They, even though, you know, what was what they were taking was worth a lot more than what the Palestinians actually owed in taxes, but they didn't give in. They organized also to try to be independent by boycotting Israeli products. Israel floods the market with our product. In Beit Zahor, also my mom's town, they managed to get 18 cows so they can start their own dairy farm and produce dairy products, their own milk. And how did Israel respond to that? It declared these cows a national security threat. And it went into Beit Zahor looking for these cows. And there is a film, actually, that came out a couple years ago on this, if you want to see. It's called The Wanted 18 Cows. Other things, you know, like Palestinians, if protesting something would shut down, you know, a flyer would go out saying, we're boycotting or we're shutting down, and all shops across the West Bank and Gaza and Jerusalem would shut their doors in protest over what killed somebody, or if it was you know, something else that they were protesting. And why does this make sense to kind of shut our own shops down when you're kind of just hurting yourself economically? You're not hurting really Israel economically by shutting your shops down. They did this in a message of we're controlling our lives. The military occupation controls everything. They open, they can close your schools, they can tell you when you're under curfew. Open, closed. And so Palestinians were saying, no, we are controlling our lives. We're determining when we're opening, when we're closing. And this infuriated Israeli soldiers, which would come through these towns, break the locks on these shop doors, forcing them to open. Which Palestinians, if they had a spare lock, they would lock it again. If they didn't, they'd leave it open. Nobody took anything, but it is, you know, this massive defiance. That Intifada came to an end in, like I said, with Oslo peace accords, and then, as I mentioned, what happened. It wasn't. Palestinians were willing to give Oslo a chance, even though we were skeptical, and then what happened was what the skeptics thought would happen is Israel just continued colonizing, cemented its occupation. So when Palestinians protested Ariel Sharon going up on Haram Sharif and the Intifada spiral, it wasn't about, okay, just this provocative act. It was really a message saying, we don't want to have anything else to do with this facade of a peace process. We're not taking part. This is not a peace process. And that is why the Intifada continued. So anyway, this is stuff that I learned about my own history, but where does that leave me and what I can do? I learned also why most Palestinians, you know, pulled back and stopped protesting because of the experience, you know, how we controlled and the really this sense of empowerment during the First Intifada and how that was ripped from us, taken away, and things became even worse in the year 2000. And then when we did take to the streets in the beginning, we were being killed and blamed for our own death. So it was, it became more of, you know, Israel's large-scale policy is to take our land without the people. It wants to push us out. It's really more important to find a way to stay on our land and not necessarily these demonstrations that we don't feel is having, you know, there it is going to bring us our freedom in this way. With me and a few others, we decided at that point that it might help them to globalize the Intifada. Let's try to, you know, understanding all of this, understanding the power dynamics, let's call people from all around the world to come stand with us here. And I had this, like, naive, I was young and naive, but it's not bad to be naive and to act on that, because sometimes we dream of a better world. So I say I'm naive. A journalist called me that once, but I say it with pride. So I really dream that thousands of people would come. And it would be this massive civilian army that would just block the Israeli military from coming into Palestinian towns and villages. But at the same time, I didn't know if anybody would come, because my own parents were calling from the U.S., really scared, saying, "Are you going to come home?" And I could say, "No, I am. Anybody let their loved one then travel to a war zone?" You know, we didn't know, but we put out the call, and, you know, thousands didn't come. Our first campaign, I mean, not even hundreds. But so August 2001, 50 people answered our call, and they came mainly from the United States and the UK. And we had a 2-week campaign after which those people went home, and they told others about what they saw with their own eyes, so sharing these personal stories, kind of bypassing what the mainstream media was reporting, and then more people wanted to come. So we invited them, and we had another campaign, and another campaign after that. 4 concrete things I believe the international solidarity movement does, or that we were aiming to do. 1 is to provide protective accompaniment. If Palestinians protesting alone were being shot and killed, and nobody cared. We thought maybe with internationals with us, the Israeli military will be a little bit more careful. The government has more accountability then, because there are people that have governments that actually care about them and might hold the Israelis accountable. 2, we wanted to change the way the mainstream media was reporting. I mean, this is not a conflict of Palestinians versus Israelis or Christians and Muslims versus Jews. What this is a conflict of, and I don't even like to use the word conflict, but this is freedom versus colonization, occupation, oppression. And if you're on the side of freedom, then I don't care where you come from what religious background, you can come stand with us. And if we created that kind of message, maybe the mainstream media will hear us. And if they don't, these people going back to their own home countries can create this alternative media and spread the word and initiate local campaigns then to change their own government's policies, which support Israel, which enables Israel's continued occupation and colonization. And 4, which to me really is the most important, is this personal, people-to-people, person-to-person solidarity. Because Israel's policies create this tremendous form of feeling of isolation. I mean, we can't travel You can't go from Gaza to the West Bank. You can't go within the West Bank without going through Israeli checkpoints. And I don't want to confuse the talk by showing you pictures. Maybe I will at the end of how Israel treats Palestinians just trying to go from one Palestinian town to the other. And if you don't have specific permission, you can get turned back. Israel, an Israeli soldier anywhere has the right to stop a Palestinian, ask for his or her ID card, and if they don't have the right ID card for where you're from, you're not supposed to be here, they can detain them, they can arrest them, they frequently abuse them. And so just getting to visit, you know, whether you're going to visit family, going to school, getting to the hospital, you have to go through Israel. They have that kind of control over your life. And then trying to leave the country is a whole another story. And then so when you feel like you're up, when you know that this is what you're up against, and one of the most powerful militaries in the world is trying to take your land and get rid of you, and this military might be supported by the only superpower in the world today, it's a tremendous form or feeling of being alone and creates a sense of hopelessness. So we wanted to break that. And International Coming can do that. And a story that I frequently tell because it really drove it home to me how important this was. It was in 2002. The Israeli military was in every Palestinian town and city and conducting military operations. So the ISM, we weren't doing, you know, structured campaigns. We were receiving internationals, training them kind of emergency crash course training, and sending them in small affinity groups or teams to some of the most hard hit, where Israel was conducting its biggest operations. And one of those places was the Palestinian city of Nablus. And at this particular point, the Israeli soldiers were going home to home. And not even going through the door, but because the homes are so close together, especially in the refugee camp, they were detonating holes in the walls because the homes were really separated by one wall. So they detonate holes in the walls and crawl from one house to the other, ransack the homes. They were rounding up Palestinian men between the ages of 15 and 50. And the international really couldn't do much. I mean, but they were trying to follow the soldiers around to say that we're watching you, in the hopes that it would lessen the violence being used against the civilians. And I was in Jerusalem doing the training when I got a phone call. And it was a man in Nablus, and he identified himself just by, you know, I'm sitting here with my family in Nablus, and the soldiers are going to come to us soon, and your internationals are not going to be able to do anything to help me or my family. But he says, we see them there in the streets. And so I just want to say thank you. And he hung up. And I never knew his name. But that's just the power of knowing that somebody cares. And that continues to be really, I think, something that we, you know, when you doubt the power that you have to make change, because sometimes it seems like, you know, they're so big and what are we doing? Just know that these little gestures, they're not so little, but so the ISM continues to operate, standing with Palestinians as they're not trying to protect their land from continued confiscation. Israel has built a horrific apartheid wall. We were in the beginning able to send small teams to Gaza also. I haven't talked about Gaza much. That ended in 2003, pretty much. When we were sending small teams to Gaza to do almost the same thing, but in Gaza, the Israeli military was, you didn't really see the soldiers as much. They were firing at people from their military watchtowers. And they were demolishing whole scale near the border with Egypt. They were demolishing a lot of homes where we sent our teams. And in March of 2003, one of our teams was trying to stop the demolition of a Palestinian home, and specifically one of our activists, a young American activist by the name of Rachel Corey. She was staying with a Palestinian pharmacist that, you know, the bulldozers came to demolish his home. And so, you know, she's wearing a reflective vest as we did in these circumstances, and standing in front of the home. For 2 hours, the bulldozer driver's like advancing, pulling back, advancing, pulling back, as she was standing in his way and talking to him the whole time, and in fact saying, like, what would your mother think of what you're doing, through a megaphone. And I don't know what went through his mind, but after about 2 hours, he advanced and he did. Shortly thereafter, the Israelis opened fire in Jenin on another ISM activist. He survived, but he was shot in the face and has had to undergo a lot of reconstructive surgery. And also within that same time period, almost a week later, 3 weeks on from after Rachel Corrie was killed, a British peace activist, a young photography student. He was almost in the same area where Rachel was killed. Israeli soldiers were firing from a watchtower into this neighborhood, and bullets were ricocheting, and two kids were just standing there terrified. So he went to move them out of the line of Israeli fire, and as he bent down to pick up a child, he was sniped in the back of the head. He lay in coma. Tom Herndahl, he lay in coma for 9 months, and then he died. Also within that same time period, the Israelis shot and killed a BBC journalist, James Miller. So within a very short time period, in the spring of 2003, Israel was getting scrutinized because it was injuring and killing internationals. So instead of changing any kind of policy, instead of any government trying to hold Israel accountable by sanctioning Israel, no, kind of slap on the wrist at most. And what Israel did then is completely shut Gaza off to internationals. So we couldn't send teams there anymore. And that remained the case until 2008. In that time, 2006, there was international pressure for Palestinians to have an election. We did. The international community didn't like who we voted for. And we voted for Hamas. And we voted for Hamas because just to really counter the corruption of Fatah, the biggest political party. But Palestinians were really punished for that. And no place more than Gaza. 2007, there was a conflict between Hamas and Fatah in Gaza. Over, and so Israel completely sealed Gaza, greatly reduced products that were coming in, what could come out. Before that, in 2005, they pulled their illegal settlers out, and they said, we ended the occupation of Gaza. You know, Gaza is free now. What they did, they took out their illegal settlers. They're still surrounding us all the way. And even by, they have their military, their navy at sea, they have all of their soldiers along the border, and they control the airspace. So nothing is in or out of Gaza without Israel's permission and or approval. Even the border that we have with Egypt, Rafah, is indirectly controlled by Israel because of the peace deal between Egypt and Israel. So Egypt will not let anything in if Israel does not approve. Everything coming in and out is controlled by Israel. Therefore, Israel did not end the occupation of Gaza because the measure in international law of an occupied territory is not, you know, the boots that you have on the ground. It's how much what they call effective control a state has over a territory. And Israel, by all means, controls Gaza. And therefore, very much what Gaza's diet, what they have for dinner on any given night, is controlled by Israel. What did they, you know, what aid trucks they allow in that day. And they had some draconian policies, which we managed to change a little bit. But just to give you an example, in 2007 and 2008, they weren't letting in school supplies. They weren't letting in, and they're still not letting in, construction supplies. They're not letting in chlorine or the piping that they need, Gaza needs to address its sewage system and sewage crisis, to the extent that 100 million liters of partially or completely untreated sewage is being dumped into the Mediterranean every single day. 100 million liters, because Israel will not allow Gaza to fix its sewage system. They have, on the border with the water, we have, you know, Israel has also not only closed Gaza, but it's launched 3 major military assaults. And so demolished thousands of factories, schools, homes, and killed people that it didn't, civilians that it did not allow to become refugees. So bombs are falling, and people are trying to run, and they have nowhere to run because all the borders are closed. And so in a war situation, civilians weren't even allowed to become refugees. And so with the economy decimated, you have upwards of 45% unemployment rate, factories completely destroyed, even if they weren't destroyed, the raw materials that you're able to import is controlled by Israel, and if you're trying to export something that you do produce, that's controlled by on the rise. And you have people that are at least trying to survive on their farmland. There is agricultural land in Gaza, but a third of that agricultural land falls inside Gaza, but Israel has declared this area a no-go zone. As far as it's concerned, it's too close to the border with Israel, so if anyone goes in there, they get shot at. Fishermen, about 3,700 fishers, men and women, in Gaza, if they stray more than 3 miles out into the water to try to catch some decent fish, they get shot at by the Israeli Navy. And so therefore, not only do they not have a good supply of fish in this small, I mean, Gaza is only 360 kilometers, square kilometers. That is about 27 times smaller than Melbourne. And people have nowhere to go. And so if they try to fish more than 3 miles out, they get shot at and they're forced to fish in this polluted water. Now that Israel has greatly reduced the power supply, so right now Gaza's only getting 4 to 6 hours of electricity per day. 90% of the people, 4 to 6 hours of electricity per day. The other 10% of people don't have electricity at all. This includes everything. This includes, you know, the schools, homes, hospitals. Hospitals is amazing because how do you run a hospital when you don't have electricity? What happens when the electricity cuts? What happens to the incubators? You know, how do you run dialysis? Half the medical centers and hospitals in Gaza are shut down now because they can't run. There are some generators, but the generators don't last forever in this kind of situation, and you're not allowed to import generators. And so if you can't get the medical attention you need inside Gaza, people look to leave. What happens if you try to leave? You need Israel's permission to leave. And they delay it. Sometimes they don't give it at all. In 2017, 54 patients died waiting for permission from Israel to leave to get treated, including newborn babies. So this is a situation when, end of 2006, some of us were like, nobody's doing anything about this humanitarian catastrophe that's happening, and it's a man-made one. So a friend from Australia, actually, sends us all an email, a former ISF activist, sends us all an email, and he says, why don't we sail a boat to Gaza? And some of us, well, me, I thought that was ridiculous because, you don't have hope. You have the Israeli military there, the Israeli Navy there, and we don't have money to get a boat. And nobody knew the first thing about boats, and so I thought that was a little bit weird. But as time went on and nothing else was being done, the reports were coming out, the UN, all the human rights organizations issuing reports condemning Israel, nobody was doing anything. So then we became a little bit more serious about, why not? Let's try to fundraise to get these boats, and we'll sail from Cyprus, not enter Israeli waters at all, go straight to Gaza's waters and into Gaza. And in that way, honestly, we didn't think we were going to get into Gaza at all. But the point was, we're going to be unarmed civilians, okay, so we're not the terrorists that Israel likes to tell the world Palestinians are. We come from mainly these Western countries. We are not going into Israeli waters. And we're going to just sail into Gaza. If Israel stops us then, let the whole world see that Israel's policy is not about security, which is why it says it's doing what it's doing to Gaza. It's not about security. It's about punishing, persecuting an entire civilian population that is illegal, that is immoral, and it has to stop. And we hope to create an outcome. And so we started raising money, which was not easy because who's going to give you money to buy a boat to go challenge the Israeli Navy? Not many people. So, but in the summer of 2008, in massive debt, we acquired 2 dilapidated fishing boats, converted them to be able to make this journey, and we set sail, 44 people from about 17 different countries. And before that, we had trained, telling people, thinking of all possible scenarios, we might be arrested, Israel might try to blow up our boats, they might sink our boats, they might try to make it look like we were incompetent, we sank ourselves, they might blow us out of the water. People can get really seriously injured or maybe even killed. And so we said that if anyone is not willing to take this risk, then don't got off our communications. And as we're approaching, you know, God's territorial waters where we thought we were going to get, we would be intercepted, there was supposed to be a media boat to come meet us that we stoned the attack, and they got lost and they never made it. But one cellular satellite phone suddenly got reception, and we got the news that Israel was not going to intercept our boats. It was a last minute decision, and they stepped down. And so it became kind of a dream, it became reality to us that we're actually going to get to Gaza. That's like the only scenario we had not prepared for. So most of us didn't know what to do, but we're sailing towards Gaza, which was kind of the most beautiful sight. And as we're getting closer, and you see the port, and you see thousands of rocks on this old port. And as we got closer, I realized that those all these rocks that I thought were rocks from so far away weren't rocks at all. They were people, thousands and thousands of people that had rushed to the port when they heard that we were coming, that the boats were coming and they were not going to be stopped. And really, they treated us like heroes. The warmest welcome, so excited. And not because we were carrying humanitarian aid, we weren't carrying anything. We were carrying balloons and a few dozen hearing aids. But that's it. But so excited because people stood up to the Israeli military. And no one had ever done that. But there was an outcry, and that's what's important. You know, I talk about what we're doing in the outcry, I talk about the, you know, being on the boats, but the important part is not really being on the boats. It's being thousands of people taking to the streets in their home countries protesting this outrage. That's what caused the big backlash, and that's what caused Israel to change some of its policies in terms of what it let into Gaza. It was a superficial change, but it actually caused change. Like, suddenly, instead of, you know, before I said they weren't letting in paper and school supplies, they weren't letting in tea and chocolate, these were luxuries. They weren't letting in, it was ridiculous. The UN, director of the UN operations in Gaza told me one, they even turned back a shipment that had 2-in-1 shampoo and conditioner because shampoo was allowed, but conditioner was not. So it was that, it's like the basic minimum. And, you know, Israel, Israeli advisors, and are famous for saying you're going to put Palestinians on a diet. So just the basic minimum what they need so they're not dying. And that's what people of Gaza are living under. So they attacked that boat, that flotilla. There was a backlash. Some policy was changed. But also, artists canceled their tours in Israel. We had longshoremen or dock workers refused to unload Israeli ships. And we had these actions taking place around the world in support. And so that was a really strong action that we're building on and we continue to build on today. The situation right now is no better than I've just described. But what is happening is that international solidarity is continuing. It's increasing. Palestinians in 2004-2005 really recognizing that we're not Palestinians inside the occupied territory. We're not going to be able to do this alone. We've tried various forms of resistance. We've tried negotiating with Israel. We've tried all these people-to-people programs to convince them that we're really human beings. We've tried to convince them of our humanity. And the colonization project continues. So the pressure has to come from outside. And that's why the call for global boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And it is ongoing, and it is powerful, and it is scaring Israel. In the United States, they've invested millions of dollars to break it. They're launching these ridiculous lawsuits against us, which they are losing. And so they're buying Congress people to pass legislation to try to stop us. But those, you know, although shamefully, about half of the states in the United States have passed legislation against boycotting, when it comes to taking them to court, and when they do affect individuals, we will take them to court. There are two court cases right now ongoing. Israel's already lost one, and the anti-boycott, anti-Palestinian human rights people lost one, and they will lose the other. And so they are reactionary. They're becoming more ridiculous, and their policies are becoming more oppressive on the ground, and they probably will continue. Some of you, I think, wanted me to talk about. I will talk about in the closing session about Ahed and the large number of Palestinians that are being arrested, children in our campaign against that. I'm going to wrap up really by saying that, you know, we are stressing the importance of solidarity here, and it really is a powerful force. We will be fought, but in the end, we're sure that we will win. Our struggles are in different ways, but they are united. And if you want to come to Palestine, we will receive you with open arms, but you don't have to be in Palestine. You don't have to be on the boats in many ways. I personally had to leave Palestine because Israel does not allow my husband in. And now we have two small kids, and therefore, so as to not separate the kids from their father, I'm based now in the United States. And was devastated about leaving. But Palestinians told me, you know, that the fight is really outside. And therefore, the importance of each and every one of us. And that's why I want to thank you again for being here. And I know I talk a lot, so for sitting through that. And I guess if we have time for question and answer, I'd love to.